Orson Welles, usually heard at this time, is unable to broadcast today. Instead, the American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations present Cary Longmire in a commentary from Washington. And now, here is Cary Longmire.
The cries grow more and more shrill. War with Russia. The diplomatic battle of Paris grows more strident. Molotov and Burns there in Paris make more of their fist-shaking speeches. The tension tightens in China, in Greece, in Palestine. And one hears those three words tossed about here in America more and more. War with Russia. Many Americans say we ought to declare war on Russia at once. Many others say, in the age of the atomic bomb, it's certain that war will break someday, and equally certain that destruction of New York, Washington, Detroit may follow. So, that argument continues, why wait until the Russians have the bomb? Why not launch a preventive war now? All of us have heard those three fighting words, the calls for war. 13 months after a bolt of man-made lightning wiped out 100,000 human beings in a fraction of a second at Hiroshima in Japan, mankind is in such a state of jitters, in other words, that scores of Americans now urge aggression. We don't like the way the Russians have been acting. Many Americans think the Russians are being stupid, to say the least, in their continual shouting of threats from an Anglo-American bloc. But is war, a war launched against Russia by us, any real answer? Yet, one can find plenty of officers of the Army who think we should start that war and get it over with. Congressman Cox of Georgia, who seems to see Bolsheviks under every bed, has called publicly on the floor of Congress for such a war. Just 2 years ago, our armies were battling the Nazis in France. Tens of thousands of boys from Kansas and California and Pennsylvania were dying. 4 years ago, there was a raging battle for Guadalcanal. Is the memory of those who call so glibly for war today so short that they have forgotten that bloodshed and heartbreak? Yet the cry goes on, war with Russia. Certainly there are arguments today between Washington and Moscow, and big arguments. Ever since the actual shooting war stopped, a gigantic battle of power politics has raged all over this globe. It's nonsense to pretend that we are completely right and the Russians completely wrong, or vice versa. This name-calling contest does no credit to either side. We in the British, for instance, bolster up an outmoded monarchy in Greece, a Franco in Spain, a Chiang Kai-shek in China. Moscow backs a different set of horses. It backs up Tito in Yugoslavia, a left-wing Polish regime in Poland, and makes gestures of blandishment in the direction of the communists in Germany. We play the battle of the zones of influence just as much as do the Russians. There's no use in our pretending a holier-than-thou attitude, and our Secretary of State Burns and Russia's Foreign Commissar Molotov both know it. What's lost on both sides is the simple idea of justice in the world. The old and simple idea in the Declaration of Independence, the right of men, women, and children to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We and the people of Britain are obviously thinking not of justice when we cynically accept the London government's stern refusal to permit homeless Jews into Palestine. What we are thinking about is simply one thing, the possibility of war with the Russians. London and Washington want at all costs to avoid explosive riots and disorders there in the Holy Land for fear that those riots will spread all over the Middle East and permit the Russians perhaps to move in there under the guise of mediation. And the Middle East, of course, holds the greatest oil reserves of the world, oil which is vital to the British and American navies in case of war. Thus, the Palestine issue is not being settled on any simple issue of justice for the Jews or for the Arabs. Every diplomatic decision in the world today, every decision in Washington and London as well as in Moscow, is colored by straight, outright fear, by the fear of war. Those men who gave their lives at Saint Lô in France, at Guadalcanal, and at Stalingrad and Orel, too, in Russia, did not die just to lay the foundation for a new and more fierce war, yet that, today, is the obvious inference. Yet what would be the gain, really, for either side, which won, if an atomic war broke today between America and Russia? That war would obviously involve the entire globe. If we think we made sacrifices to beat Hitler and Hirohito, those sacrifices would be nothing compared to the tremendous expense of men and money which would be necessary to bludgeon huge Russia into submission. In place of a million or so American casualties, there might be 10 million. And what would we gain, really, after dropping atomic bombs on Moscow and Leningrad and Stalingrad and the rest of the cities of Russia? The Russian people would still mostly be there. Millions of them would be wiped out, starved, but millions more would have retreated into Siberia. guerrilla war with those Russian survivors would go on for years if we think that our military government of Germany has been a conspicuous failure today. Just how would American troops run that vast land of Russia also? To win that huge and gigantic war with Russia, a war which would take place both in Europe and in Asia, would then mean that America would be forced to feed about half the population of the globe at least. Plague and disease would certainly fill the earth. It would take at least a century, possibly more, to rebuild any sort of civilization. Do those who talk so glibly of war with Russia ever think of these inevitable results? Today, the United States is confronted with two chief issues. One, of course, is the rising cost of living. The other is how to improve relations with Russia, how to put a stop, that is, to this battle of power politics, which is now giving the world the jitters. If Americans were handling the problems of the home front here a little better, the international jitters might not be quite so sharp. Last week, the Labor Department made an announcement which got very few headlines. The cost of living, we were told, in the month from July 15th to August 15th, went up by another 2%. In the previous month, that month in which Congress scuttled price control and came up with a new price law with virtually no teeth in it, the index of living costs had jumped by 6%. There has been no two-month period in history in which the cost of living in this country has soared so hugely. A rise of 8% means that millions of families can now buy less meat, less milk, less bread. Children cannot get their extra pair of shoes. Perhaps an insurance policy must be canceled in many families, and the cost of living is still rising. It's no wonder that the nation is torn by strikes. Strikes in shipping, in other spots, and threatened strikes all over the land. What else did Congress expect anyway last June and July when it listened to those hordes of Washington lobbyists who shouted so violently against price control? Congressman Sabbath of Illinois, who has served 40 years in Congress and is the dean of the House, said then, during that debate on OPA, that he had never seen anything like the outright manipulation of legislation in Congress by lobbyists. Chester Bowles, then stabilization director, warned that if price control were weakened, the cost of living would soar so sharply that a new wave of labor disorders in the nation would be inevitable in about 60 to 90 days. Well, something like 70 days have now passed, and Chester Bowles was eminently correct. The strikes are here. More strikes are doubtless coming. Mr. Bowles, disgusted with the way things were going in Washington, is making a bid tomorrow before the Connecticut State Democratic Convention in Hartford, Connecticut, for the governorship of Connecticut. The rising living costs, the wave of strikes, are two more things which ought to be pondered by those Americans who shout so violently today for war with Russia or for war with anyone else. Haven't they stopped to think that if a new war breaks, there will be much more inflation? That the pressure then for soaring prices and soaring wages cannot possibly be stopped? War inevitably brings huge economic dislocation. If we launched a new war today, we would see such a wave of inflation tomorrow that no insurance policy and no bank account might eventually be worth a nickel. Those who wish to strengthen the capitalist system, as I think virtually all of us Americans do, are playing with dynamite when they talk so glibly of this proposed war against the communists across the seas. Is plunging the world into anarchy any way to preserve capitalism or democracy? The debate on all this was pointed up sharply last week by President Truman's rather comic slip in his offhand comment at his Thursday news conference on Henry Wallace's Thursday night speech in New York, the speech in which Mr. Wallace lashed out bitterly at the present policy of getting tough with Russia, being followed by Secretary of State Burns, a policy endorsed, of course, by President Truman. If the topic were not so full of potential tragedy, and any major war today would be the most utter tragedy the world has ever seen, to repeat, if the topic were not so filled with potential tragedy, the story would be very funny. The moral might be drawn that President Truman has a positive gift for putting his foot in his mouth. The president is in such hot water today that even the Republicans probably feel a little sorry for him. But the country wonders how long it will take for the president to learn to quit making offhand statements which set off sensations all over the world. Everyone knows by now how President Truman's slip on Thursday came about. Secretary Wallace was due to make a speech that night, and the Wallace speech warned that if we simply tried to combat Russian influence by a shouting contest with Moscow, by a war of words, then we will get nowhere. Mr. Wallace went on to say that it is no more business of ours what Russia does in Eastern Europe than it is Russia's business what we do at the Panama Canal and in the Western Hemisphere. Now, this was obviously a slashing attack from within President Truman's own official family on his policy, and the policy, incidentally, of Secretary of State Burns. At first, when a correspondent asked him about the speech, the president interrupted and said no, he couldn't comment on a speech still unmade, since this was Thursday afternoon and Mr. Wallace was not speaking until that night. Then the president's agreeable nature got the better of him. He told the correspondent, yes, he had read Mr. Wallace's speech, and yes, Mr. Wallace was correct in saying Mr. Truman agreed with the speech. Further, the president said he saw no difference in the Wallace and the Burns views. Well, a sensation, obviously enough, hit Paris immediately, hit London and Moscow, too. Senators Connolly and Vandenberg, who were there in Paris with Mr. Burns, immediately issued statements demanding, in effect, to know what the president was thinking about anyway in cutting the ground out from under his own Secretary of State. Opinion in London was caustic. Senator Taft and other Republicans wanted to know, how many policies does this government have anyway? Finally, yesterday afternoon, the abashed Mr. Truman called in the White House reporters to read a brief statement. He said he had answered the question on Thursday so quickly that his answer didn't convey his full meaning. All he meant, he insisted grimly, was that he approved the right of Henry Wallace to make his speech. But this is not the first time that President Truman has been in hot water over his offhand comments. The president is an eminently agreeable man. About a year ago, down in Tennessee, Mr. Truman was enjoying himself at a party at Real Foot Lake one night with his traveling White House party and the news correspondents. He beamed subtly at the newsmen and said he didn't know why he couldn't tell them what he thought about the atomic bomb. The effect of his statement, made strictly off the cuff, so to speak, was that we, in this country, had made the bomb, we had the bomb, and what did any other country want to do about it anyway? Well, that belligerent comment got not only Moscow mad, it got London mad, too, and Ottawa as well. Prime Minister Attlee of Britain rushed to Washington, and Mr. Truman had to back down on his atomic pronouncement. The three governments would work for international controls, it was announced, of the terrible atomic weapon. When Winston Churchill came to America to make his belligerently anti-Russian speech at Fulton, Missouri, the president might diplomatically have sidestepped any endorsement of that fiery challenge to Moscow. President Truman did not sidestep any such endorsement, however. He blithely rode to Missouri with Mr. Churchill in a special train. He sat on the platform with Mr. Churchill and beamed at the audience. Who could doubt, after that, that he gave the Churchill words his full endorsement. And that speech of Mr. Churchill today in Moscow is being cited by the Russians as prime proof that the outer world wants war with Russia. Yet, after that Missouri incident, Mr. Truman turned around on Thursday here and asserted that he endorsed a speech of Henry Wallace's, whose effect was exactly the reverse of the Churchill speech. Yesterday, the agreeable president had to back down. The question is thus commencing to arise here as to just where agreeableness ends and a real hard-thought policy begins. The current strike situation can be traced straight back to last February. The nation's steel industry then was tied up by a strike. Chester Bowles and his economists were prepared to grant a moderate price increase on steel, coupled with a moderate wage boost to settle the strike. John Snyder, President Truman's friend, then reconversion boss, stepped in suddenly and granted the steel companies a price boost double what the economists had recommended. President Truman comfortably agreed. He said this was just a little bulge in the inflation line and that the bulge would not expand into a wide break. The price control and wage control officials, though, were baffled and exasperated. Their agreeable president and his pal, Mr. Snyder, had wrecked their plans for really tough controls to keep prices and wages in hand and stop inflation. Well, today, as we can all see, the bulge in the inflation line is an open hole in the dike. Today, relations with Russia, too, the second big problem of our time, are equally bad. Agreeableness in Washington does not seem to be any substitute, one might say, for real policies.
You have just heard Kerry Longmire in a special commentary from Washington. Orson Welles, who is usually heard at this time, will be back over many of these same stations next Sunday. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.